Today's episode is brought to us by Umbris sunglasses. They are armless, they have a cord, they are amazing. I love mine. I can take them anywhere. They won't fall off while I mountain bike. And if you would like to get a pair, go to Instagram, find Umbras, O-M-B-R-A-Z, send them a message, and they're giving away 3 free pair this month. Something else I like to take with me anywhere is a couple packs of CS Instant Coffee. If I can't drag along all my coffee equipment, I do have that option to have incredible coffee in the backcountry or anywhere I go. Go to csinstant.coffee and use the code ADVENTURE at checkout for a discount on their incredible instant coffee.
Our whole mentality when we start was just go, go, go. We were trying to get down to the Sierra by January when it's generally more stable. And so our whole mentality was just put the miles in, put the time in, and just get as far south as possible.
This is the Adventure Sports Podcast, trying to help you find adventure every day. In any stage of life, you're going to hear from explorers, adventurers, business owners, and anyone living their life a little more out of the box than usual. So it is pretty much winter now, and you know, there's skiing, there's snowboarding, there's all the winter sports for sure. But something we don't think about a lot is that, you know, you can still hike and snowshoe and travel in the winter with the right equipment and with the right amount of experience. And even the through hikes are not off limits at this time of year. And I know a lot of you are probably, concerned that the trails are overcrowded, you know, especially the through hikes, the big three in the country, the Triple Crown. It can be sometimes not really feel like a wilderness experience. But today's guest, this is a throwback actually to 2017. He was able to do the PCT in the winter this time of year and really get a wilderness exciting experience. So it's definitely not off limits. I know with the lottery systems that are in place on the PCT and probably going to be in place in the future on a lot of other trails, this is definitely a viable option for a lot of people. And so I hope you enjoy, hope you get some new ideas and think a little bit outside the box with doing something you don't really associate with the winter, doing it in the winter. But anyway, I hope you enjoy. Hope you're getting excited for Christmas coming around and in the giving spirit. So have a great rest of your week and talk to you on Monday.
Hello and welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. This is your host, Kurt Linville. Wow, I've got a guy that you are all going to want to hear a lot about, and we can't begin to cover all of his adventures in one show. So we're going to narrow it down to one adventure. But Sean Forey is on the line, and Sean grew up in Pennsylvania, and then he started working with Outward Bound, and from there that led to an adventure-focused lifestyle, and he has done major through hikes all over the United States. So he holds the Triple Crown, but not only the Triple Crown, he's found innovative ways to do things and to do other long trails and innovative trails and projects, and I'm really excited to visit with Sean to pick his brain a little bit about this amazing backpacking lifestyle and adventure-focused lifestyle. So, Sean, thanks for being on the program.
Yeah, thanks, Kurt, for having me.
So, Sean, I want to start by mentioning Justin Lichter. And the reason is that the main thing we're going to talk about today was that you and Justin did the Pacific Crest Trail in the wintertime in 2014-15. And that's quite the feat. That's amazing. And I want to say hats off to Justin and to you for pulling that off. Justin was not able to join us tonight, regretfully. Maybe we can get him on a future show, which would be awesome. But I'm glad that you could be here to share the tale with us.
Yeah, no worries.
So I want to just kind of dive into your website for just a minute so people kind of get a feel for who you are and the kinds of things that you've been up to over the last several years. And this is going to get a little bit long, but I think it's worthwhile. 2003, Appalachian Trail. 2004, Pacific Crest Trail. 2005, Wainwright's Way, which is 185-mile coast-to-coast from St. Bees to Robin Hood Bay in England. 2005, GR20. That was 110 miles from Clenzana to Conca, Corsica. 2005, El Camino de Santiago, 650 miles from the Pyrenees to the Atlantic, France and Spain. 2006, Continental Divide Trail. 2007, Te Aurora. Did I say that right?
Close. Te Aurora.
I don't know if I'll ever say that right.
Yeah.
It was 850 miles from Bluff to Ship Cove, South Island, New Zealand. So that's awesome. And then 2008, man, I think we're seeing a pattern here. Hayduke Trail, 850-mile canyon country from Arches to Zion National Parks and Utah and Arizona. 2008, the Long Trail, 280-mile, America's first long-distance trail from Canada to Massachusetts border. 2009, Sierra High Route, 250-mile cross-country from Mount Whitney to Twin Lakes, California. 2010, man, we're catching up with you. Great Divide Trail, Pacific Northwest Trail, connecting the Canadian Rockies to Washington's rugged coast. 2011, the Great Himalaya Trail in Nepal. 2012, Tahoe Rim Trail, 165 miles circumnavigating North America's largest alpine lake. 2012, Colorado Trail unsupported speed record. We need to have a show about that, too. You did 485 miles from Denver, Colorado to Durango, Colorado, through the Colorado Rockies, and it's got to say how long that took.
Like 10 and a half, just over 10 and a half days.
10 and a half days. Wow. That's pretty amazing. So in 10 and a half days, that means you're averaging about 45 to 50 miles a day.
Yeah, I think it was about 45 miles per day.
Wow. That's crazy. Okay. 2013, High Sierra Ski Traverse, 150-mile Sonora Pass to Mammoth Lakes. 14-15, and this is the one we're going to spend time on today, the Pacific Crest Trail Winter Traverse, 2,660 miles, linking Canada to Mexico through the Cascades and the Sierra. And this is the one that you did with Justin, which is amazing. Winter time on the PCT. 2015, Wind River Range High Route, 180 miles through the spine of the Wind River Range. That's Wyoming. 2015, Teton Crest Route, 65-mile jaunt into the heart of the Tetons. You also did a low-to-high route in 2015. That was 135-mile connecting the lowest and highest point in the lower 48. So I'm assuming this is Death Valley to Mount Whitney. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Wow. So I guess now everyone's jaws dropped, and they're thinking, whoa, how does this guy find the time to do this much through hiking and backpacking? And it kind of makes you sound like an animal, man, I have to say.
Or maybe I'm just an addict. I don't know. It's hard to distinguish the two.
Well, tell us just a little bit about that. How do you find the time? How did you create a lifestyle that allowed for all this? It's great.
Well, I think for me, just the trip in the summer became the priority. That's sort of what I built my calendar and built my life around. And hiking is surprisingly like very cheap thing to do. You're literally just walking and feeding yourself. So I would usually work two or three jobs in the winter and just save up. And I think just living a really frugal lifestyle, it's amazing how much you can save and just put towards another adventure. So once you sort of figure out that your yearly routine of piecing together work and then putting all that energy into a trip, it just becomes sort of the day of the almost like a yearly migration.
Well, I think that's really neat. And, you know, a lot of people, they get a couple of weeks off a year and that's pretty much all they're going to have. You've been planning the summer trip. Did your work with Outward Bound allow you that flexibility? Is that how that worked out?
Yeah, fortunately for me, Outward Bound provides year-round work if you want it. So I can sort of piece together if I wanted to work a couple courses in the summertime or in the fall or in the winter, you know, depending on which trip, what time of year the trip I wanted to do needed to take place, I could sort of build my work schedule around that. So it was a great way to have meaningful work that also sort of built my own skill sets and kept me in shape for the next trip and kept me outside.
Well, hey, since we mentioned Outward Bound, I want to ask you, a lot of people have heard of Outward Bound. I don't think a lot of people really know what Outward Bound is. So you're a director with Outward Bound now, right?
Yeah, I'm the program director for the High Sierra program here in California.
That's great. So you're the perfect guy to ask. Give us the bullet points. What is Outward Bound really?
We're not a for troubled kids, although we do have programs for that. That's the most common misconception. But the way I like to think of it is we are a program that provides character development. So these sort of abstract skills, life skills, whether it's like leadership, communication, decision-making, things you don't tend to learn in an academic setting. An Outward Bound course is structured to send you on an expedition where these things will inherently come out over the course of a couple days to a couple weeks, depending how long the course is. So students on our courses are presented a series of challenges, and they're not contrived challenges. You're out there learning a new skill, whether it's backpacking or climbing or skiing or dog sledding. And there's just natural consequences of learning from your mistakes out there.
Oh, yeah. So what's the age range of the students that you guys work with?
We work with students all the way down to 12 and as old as 65 plus, including veterans of foreign wars.
Oh, that's great. So you've been with Outward Bound now for 10 or 11 years. That's a pretty long run. If people are interested in that kind of work, how do they get into that?
I think having a well-rounded outdoor experience is really helpful. And also just, I think, having a passion to work with people. I think we're very different than guiding. A lot of people that want to come into the work to be outside to guide people, it's a slightly different approach. And we're here to sort of shape students' lives and be a part of that process. So you get to be outside while you're with people is the way I like to think of it.
Mm. Is Outward Bound affiliated with like any religious organizations or anything like that?
We're not. No, we're just a nonprofit.
So as a nonprofit, do you guys drum up business, take donations and that sort of thing? Or is the program supported from the student fees?
We have a really interesting business model where it's both. Some of our tuition or revenue comes from tuition based from courses, and a lot comes from scholar donations. So about half of our students that go on course receive some sort of scholarship or tuition reduction.
Neat. Well, I don't want to spend a lot of time on Outward Bound because I want to talk about this PCT thing. But if someone was interested in learning a skill, being challenged like you were describing, how can they get plugged in with Outward Bound to go on a trip?
Just going to our website, outwardbound.org, there's a whole menu of exciting adventures out there to check out.
So I've mentioned on the show in the past that I've had the wonderful opportunity to take a lot of inner city kids into the woods to experience nature and to backpack and that sort of thing. And we used to teach some rappelling and various things like that. I'm just amazed at the impact that nature can have on someone when maybe they didn't grow up in nature. It's kind of new to them. It can be a life-changing experience, and you get to see that, wow, all the time.
Yeah, I feel like nature is the great equalizer, and there's infinite lessons that it teaches you while you're out there. It's impressive, and I think what keeps me going out there and pursuing those life lessons.
Yeah, really, really cool. Well, hey, we talked about, I listed all these trips, and it doesn't sound like you're slowing down at all, but I'm particularly interested, like I said, in this wintertime Pacific Crest Trail trip. And so you guys are the first ones to successfully pull this off. Is that right?
That's correct. There, from our research, there was a couple that tried in the 80s that unfortunately was a fatal attempt.
They
got 100 miles in, and I think that slipped and fell somewhere in Southern California, unfortunately.
That's tough. So there's so many questions I have about this. I hardly know where to start, but let's just start with the skeleton, and then we'll hang some meat on it later, right? So you guys decided to do this in the wintertime. So when did you start and when did you finish?
We started in late October, so October 21st, and finished on March 1st. And just the concept of like winter and when did we want to start and finish, that was a long discussion between us to begin with. Just like, how do you define a winter trip? I mean, winter as a season is only 3 months long, and we felt like that wasn't, you know, practical to cover that distance in only 3 months. So the way we rationalized the concept of a winter trip and why we chose those dates were, we wanted to start after all the normal summer hikers are finished, and we wanted to finish before all the normal summer hikers start.
There you go.
So to be truly off season on the PCT.
Right. And that meant that you really were there not only for winter, but for a big chunk of fall, and almost made it to spring. So you finished before spring actually hit there.
Yeah, we were planning on probably finishing in early April, and we're able to finish a little bit on the early side.
Well, a guy that averages 45 miles on the Colorado Trail every day probably can cover some ground. So when you're talking about a 45-mile-a-day average, and we'll come back to the PCT, but were you doing it as an ultra runner, or were you truly just hiking a really long time?
Yeah, I think when it comes to distance hiking and distance speed hiking in particular, there's this like really interesting threshold where running, in my mind, becomes less efficient and walking is sort of the more superior. So I was walking the entire time, probably averaging a 3.5 mile pace, mile per hour pace. And it's just putting in the time. So putting in 18 plus hour days and not stopping.
Wow. So you're talking about doing about a 16 to 18 minute mile or something like that.
Yeah, it sounds about right. Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of ultra runners aren't going much faster than that, if any faster. It's just a different cadence. It's a different style of movement. And so that's really kind of, that's a brisk pace. It's almost speed walking.
It is. And I think the nature of just being unsupported meant that I carried all of my food from the start. So I literally had 40 pounds of food in my pack and a total pack weight of about 45 pounds when I started. So any sort of running wasn't going to be in the best interest of my knees at that point.
I'm not sure that walking 18 hours a day is in the best interest of your knees either, though.
Debatable.
Well, okay. So obviously you're a powerful hiker, you know, and when you started the PCT with Justin, then what kind of pack weights did you have and what kind of distance were you shooting for?
Well, the whole concept of the PC or doing it in the wintertime is, the way we sort of calendared the trip, there were certain places we wanted to be in certain months. So there is a direct need to sort of keep moving the entire time. So we intentionally packed as light as possible. We sort of used all of our ultralight experience from other trips and applied that to a winter setting. So our packs, I think we're probably about 30 pounds to start. And when we had our full ski kit at its heaviest point, they were probably close to 40 pounds. And we were trying to average about 20 to 25 miles a day.
So in the wintertime, 20, 25 miles, I mean, if you're snowshoeing, that would be a really good distance. If you're skiing downhill, that doesn't sound so bad. But what was your mode of travel on the snow?
We started just hiking. We were able to hike about for 3 weeks or so before the snow got too deep. And then we switched to snowshoes, and then going through the High Sierra, we switched to skis. And for the Southern, California desert, we were back in trail runners and hiking again. And the mode of travel was the crux, or like the thing we debated for the longest time. Cause it's sort of the choosing the lesser of all evils. There's no perfect mode to travel by, because the nature of the PCT is it has such huge elevation gains and losses that you're entering so many different eco zones, and snow, we were like religiously studying the snow line of how many miles we're going to be in the snow each day and how many miles might drop us out of the snow line each day. So, you know, our hope was to ski as much as possible. But just the nature of the trail and how much elevation gain and loss, snowshoeing, I think we ended up snowshoeing like 1200 miles or something like that.
Wow. You know, in Colorado, we don't have the same sort of a snow line. Instead, we have snow that goes all the way down to the trailhead. You know, you're going to be in snow up here because of the elevations that we start at. But in the West, people talk about the snow line because, you know, you've got some nice warm weather and lower elevations that turns into rain and then colder rain and then snow up on top. So I didn't even think about that, but that had to be a real challenge for you.
Yeah, I mean, it makes gear selection really challenging. The lowest point on the PCT is 300 feet and the highest point's 13,000. So that's a huge range of snow conditions or non-existent snow conditions. So the idea of walking in your ski boots through dirt trail is not appealing.
No.
So it was a lot of experimenting and sort of learning and sort of refining our systems as we went.
So let's talk a little bit about your ski gear. My sons and I put our standard alpine gear, just our downhill gear on our backs, and climbed about half a 14er with them last summer. Ditched them and summited because the snow was running out, and then came back and skied back down. But the reason I bring that up is that that's not the best way to do it. We didn't really use the lightest gear, and right. I was surprised at how much weight the ski gear, the standard gear, actually was. I mean, you couldn't easily carry multiple day supplies of food and shelter and that sort of thing and that kind of ski gear.
Yeah, and I think that's where, like, really stripping down every extraneous piece of gear and really critiquing what was going to be the essentials just to fit it in our packs. Because, I mean, at times we were carrying 10 days of food. So to fit that into a pack and have it be comfortable and stable enough to ski in, you know, it makes a huge difference. So that, you know, that even went into the style of ski gear that we chose to use. A lot of ski gear is not meant for multiple day ski tours like we were doing, or multiple week or month ski tours.
Right.
So you're sort of picking the best of both worlds and trying to make Frankenstein a kit that would sort of serve our purposes. So we sort of stole a little bit from like the ski racing, ski mountaineering,
sure,
scene with really, really light boots and bindings and sort of hybrid skis that are downhill touring skis with cross country skis that have like a pattern fish scale to them. So just with the nature of a lot of rolling terrain, having some fish scales on some downhill skis made a huge difference where we weren't constantly stopping to put our skins on and off.
I know this is an ad, but this is actually how I feel. Ombra sunglasses are amazing. They're armless, and they just have a cord that connects the frame around your head. And my son can't pull them off my head like he pulls my other sunglasses off. They won Backpackers Magazine Gear Editor's Gear Choice of the Year. They plant 20 trees for every pair they sell. And honestly, guys, I wear them every day. I take them everywhere I go. I just wore them cycling the other day on a long trip. They just perform great. I love that there's no arms on them. I slip them in the pocket of my shirt or in my pants. I don't have to worry about breaking them. Fantastic glasses. I don't have to worry about them coming off if I'm wrestling around with my son or playing with my dogs. I really do enjoy them, and I'm going to be buying more for myself for the foreseeable future. I mean, they've totally changed the way I look at sunglasses. You can check them out too at ombras.com, ombraz.com. They make a great Christmas gift. I know you can't always make coffee the way you want to in a lot of the places that we go, you know, in the backcountry or on top of a mountain somewhere. But the good news is there is a great option for coffee in the backcountry, and it's CS Instant Coffee. They make big pouches that fill, you know, 20-ounce containers with fresh coffee. Just put some hot water in there and you're good to go, or put cold water in there and then you can have some cold brew. They use 100% compostable packaging, so just in case you dropped it, please don't, but if you did, it's going to biodegrade into the ground. It's great for backcountry travel or any time you just don't feel like breaking out the coffee maker or the French press or whatever. I actually use them all the time just in my house when I don't feel like making a big pot of coffee. So check them out at csinstant.coffee and use the code ADVENTURE at checkout to get a discount.
So you did a lot of snowshoeing, you did a lot of just standard hiking, and it sounds like you did a lot of skiing. Do you have any idea what distance you covered on the skis?
I think we ended up skiing about 450 miles, snowshoeing about 1,200, and then the rest was, I think, about six or 700 miles of hiking.
Okay, so you know enough to know better. Which one did you prefer in the end?
When conditions are great, I love skiing or hiking. Snowshoeing is my least favorite. It's the thing we ended up doing the most, and it's not my most efficient mode of travel.
So I have to imagine that when you were snowshoeing, it's not like you're on packed trails like a lot of people snowshoe on. You guys were breaking trail in soft snow and variable conditions. Had to be a lot of the time.
Yeah, I mean, us looking at the weather report is just became our daily routine. Looking at the elevation profile of the trail and the weather report was going to tell us how efficient or miserable the day was going to be. So if a storm came in and we knew we were going to be above snow line, it just meant we were breaking trail. And we sort of figured out a model of travel that in hindsight is kind of ridiculous, where we realized that if one person just took a break for about 20 or 30 minutes while the other person broke trail, they could catch up to them in about 3 or 4 minutes of walking through broken trail.
That's so killer.
It's kind of a morale breaker on some days. And then, you know, other days it's bluebird and you're walking on hard packed snow or even snowless trails. So you sort of like really appreciate those easier travel days.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've done quite a bit of snowshoeing and it's still a favorite of ours. But I tell you what, I've done some long days on snowshoes, you know, 10, 11, 12 hours. And what I find is that because the snowshoes, they sink either, they don't sink straight down. They're going to lean one way or the other, depending on the density of the snow under your foot. And so it's constantly throwing your ankles and your knees one way or the other, your hips. You're constantly having to compensate for the variability of the snow. It's not like just, you know, walking on hard pack or backpacking in general. It's tough. So for you guys to cover that many miles on snowshoes, man, hats off. That's impressive.
Yeah, I feel like I have a natural bow to my leg now. Just walking that many miles in snowshoes.
Well, yeah, you have to take your steps slightly farther apart than you normally would too, because you step on your own shoe and that's no fun because then you're face planting.
Yeah.
Wow. Hey, I like that approach, though, the idea that one guy breaks trail while the other one just rests, because on our trips, one guy's breaking trail and the others are taking very slow steps and standing all the time, which is exhausting, too. So it kind of makes sense. Why not just take a break and then catch up and take a turn breaking the trail?
Yeah, it's not like we were going to lose each other. And, you know, if the terrain was benign enough or we didn't have to be together to make decisions, then you know, it was a great way to sort of multitask while, you know, we could take a snack break while the other person's breaking trail and just kind of, you know, every hour counted. And I think one thing is overlooked in the winter time is we only had about 11 hours of daylight each day. So every minute counted during the day.
Oh, yeah. Did you end up doing quite a bit of continuing on the trail in the dark?
Very rarely. Depending on what the conditions were and if it felt safe enough, we might go into dusk, maybe a half hour, an hour at most. For most days, we would just stop right at sunset.
Okay. Well, let's talk about temperatures a little bit. We've already talked about how you were low enough to be out of snow for parts of the trail and high enough to be really in snow for great distances as well. What kind of temperatures were you facing?
Well, when we finished the trip down in Southern California, we were in, a long sleeve shirt and shorts. So it was great to sort of walk into spring and finish the trip that way. And our coldest temps, there was a record breaking cold snap coming through Oregon, where I think the temps got down to like minus 10 for this really cold storm that came through. So that was sort of the range of temperatures we were looking at. And most days it was probably high 20s, just below freezing, with overnight temps maybe in the teens and low 20s.
So I like to do winter camping, but I've never been out in the cold for extended day trips, you know, day after day after day. What's it like?
I think your body just like acclimatizes to some degree. You'll come indoors after spending 10 days straight or a week straight, and it just feels really hot. But I think the really challenging thing with winter in particular is how on it you have to be with just monitoring your temperature and adjusting your layers accordingly. Because moisture management is just a huge piece of not only staying comfortable and warm, but also staying safe in the winter. So you're just constantly putting on things, taking off things, and you sort of have this menu of clothing that you can pick from and just sort of dial in whatever the conditions and temperatures are going to be for that day.
You know, we've done huge segments of shows on hypothermia. And so I encourage our listeners, if you want to explore more about that, there are some mini episodes on building emergency shelters and hypothermia and that sort of thing. And then, of course, we visit about hypothermia with a lot of different people. But hypothermia is, I think, one of its trickier aspects is that when you start to get cold and your brain chills down, then you start making stupid decisions. And that can be so dangerous. Did you guys have any issues with that?
Not directly with hypothermia. When we started in Washington in the late fall, we had 30 straight days of just either rain, sleet, snow, hail. The sun didn't come out for a month for us. And we were right at those perfect temperatures of just really miserable 35 and raining or really wet snow. And honestly, I would much rather travel in minus 10, minus 15 degree temps because the snow is really dry. It's just much easier to sort of manage the moisture than those perfect hypothermic temperatures when it's just right above freezing and really dumping rain or something.
Yeah. So the wet is the issue. That's what you're saying there.
Yeah. I mean, you just, when you feel that deep seep, when your rain gear finally gives up the ghost, it's just, you can feel your morale sort of lowering with it.
So what kind of a sleep system? I'm thinking about hiking in the rain at 35 degrees for 8, 10, 11 hours, and then trying to go to bed and be warm when I'm still out in the cold. How did you guys manage a warm sleep system when you're trying to be ultralight?
Yeah, I mean, we knew being warm and dry and sane at night was going to be a priority for the trip. And also, sleeping bags just take up a ton of space and can be really heavy. And one system that we modified that I used a lot guiding winter trips with Outward Bound was we used a light down sleeping bag and would put a synthetic overbag over top of that. So two thin bags where any moisture coming off your body at night would condensate inside the synthetic bag instead of on the down and compressing that down. So that system worked really well. We both use either quilts over bags or two quilts, synthetic and a down one. So that just gives you a wide range of temperatures you can sleep in and helps just manage all the drying of gear and the moisture that's accumulating in your sleeping bags at night.
That's a good idea. So what about the pad? You had to have some insulation.
Yeah, it's surprising how I would say more important your sleeping pad is than your sleeping bag in the wintertime. And we used Therm-Rest Neolar X-Therm. So for under a pad, it has a huge, or under a pound, it has a super high R value. And I was skeptical at first that this pad would keep us warm, but on our coldest nights, it did the trick.
So say that again. It's called the what?
It's a Thermarest NeoAir X-Therm.
So NeoAir X-Therm.
Yeah.
Great. Okay, well, let's get into more of the experience itself. It's amazing how you guys did this. You know, now we've covered your modality and your sleep system and the weather that you've had and all that kind of stuff. But what was it like? I mean, I know you've done a lot of long trips. Being out in the wilderness day after day after day is something that's not new to you. But what was it like just to be there in the winter? No one else is around, mile after mile, day after day. I can't imagine what the experience was.
Yeah, and I think to compare it to some other trails or other experiences, you know, doing another summertime hike or just something that's a little bit more familiar, there's more of an appeal of like you're going to see something new, but you sort of know that you can hike the miles, you can do the get through the terrain. It's just a matter of putting in the time and effort. And this trip in particular was slightly different where we did as much research and planning as possible, but we were still felt like we were heading into the unknown a little bit. You know, there wasn't anybody that had done it before that we could ask direct questions, or there's no guidebook on doing it in the winter. So every day became sort of a ground truthing of what we planned or anticipated might happen. So we knew some days were going to be miserable. I think you have to be upfront about that. You know, there's some excitement and appeal and humility that goes into those days. And we knew that the PCT it's an amazing trail. It's probably for Justin and I, one of our favorite trails in the world. And it's definitely gaining in popularity in the summertime. And we knew for us that, you know, we went 1700 miles without seeing anybody on the trail. So just to know that we were the only ones out there and got to experience the things we saw, just made it that much more special. So it was interesting we both had done the trail previously in the summertime to sort of travel through these familiar places, but seeing them in a totally different light and a totally different season, it just made it that much more special where, there was a bit of familiarity to the trail, but also we feel like we were rediscovering it for the first time again. And in terms of just like a daily routine that we sort of settled into is we would generally wake up before the sun got up, you know, have a cold or hot breakfast and pack up as quick as we can. Work is warmth in the wintertime, so the sooner you get moving, the quicker you're going to warm up. And you sort of just get into this like meditative state of thinking about nothing and thinking about everything at the same time. And I think that's something I really love about long distance anything. It's just you get in this routine where just is becomes the machine and your mind can sort of drift and wander, and you're sort of oscillating back and forth between needing to make really smart, informed decisions and also having the creative space just like think about anything else other than the misery of the snowshoes that you're wearing right now.
Right. You know, with that many miles on snowshoes, you either had to have some awesome snowshoes or you had to go through multiple pairs. How'd they hold up for you?
Well, we sent our snowshoes back to MSR at the end, and they definitely had a laugh at them. We completely wore them down, and they said they've never seen that much wear on a single pair of snowshoes before. So we might have the record for most miles on a pair of snowshoes. That's not confirmed.
I can't imagine. Well, how about a story about a day that things went wrong? There had to be some days that were just really, really tough.
Yeah, I think probably our lowest point. And I think just to frame tough days, just to take a step back. Like for me, I sort of look forward to those days where things don't go right or things go slightly askew. I just love being right on the edge of having to make decisions. And if a mistake happens, it's okay. And I think that's a key life lesson of sort of seeing the value in mistakes and failure and not sort of the shame and sort of resentment that can go around with failure. But our lowest point on that trip was, I mentioned earlier, there was that cold snap that came came in while we were traveling through northern Oregon, and we were aware that that storm was coming in. We hadn't quite switched over to our full winter kit yet. Our whole mentality when we started was just go, go, go. We were trying to get down to the Sierra by January when it's generally more stable and tends to be a snowless January sort of model. So our whole mentality was just put the miles in, put the time in, and just get as far south as possible. So we knew this storm was going to be rolling through with lower temps, and it came in earlier, about 3 or 4 days earlier than we anticipated. And all of our winter gear was sitting at the next town. So we were just there, you know, in our trail runners, you know, waterproof trail runners, sort of just regular summertime rain gear, just trying to get one more town in, or, you know, a handful more miles in before we switched to our heavier, slower winter kit. And that storm came in, and the temps dropped out. And when you're traveling in trail runners or, you know, hiking boots at that point, you know, they're going to freeze at night. And just getting up and traveling, and we were post-holing through about 3 feet of snow at that point. And the coldest morning we got up, and, you know, we put our feet into frozen shoes, and, you know, I told myself that morning that, okay, I'm going to stop in half hour if my feet aren't warm. And it's really hard to tell the difference between your feet being numb and your feet, being frozen. So got to our half hour window, could wiggle my toes. Things felt great. Continued on. And we generally stop about every 3 hours to take a quick snack break. And when we got to that break, as soon as I took my shoe off, you know, I knew I had some either frost nip or frostbite. And when it's at that early stage, it's really hard to tell how extensive the damage is. And Justin also had some white spots on his feet as well. So you're miles from anywhere, and you're still post-holing. Every mile that you're going to need to sort of evacuate yourself out of there, you're going to be post-holing through the same conditions. So you're sort of weighing in your mind of, for frostbite, you don't want it to refreeze. So if you commit to rewarming it in the field, you have to guarantee that you can't refreeze it. So we were at sort of that crossroads of, well, how are we going to manage this situation, and how are we going to move forward? And we decided to field rewarm and then just try and exit out to the nearest trailhead or, you know, emergency sort of road access that we could get to. So we spent a whole another day traveling about 25 miles to get to the nearest road the next day, with sort of this underlying doubt or worry of, like, how much damage did we do to our feet? So once we got out of town, you know, we had that hard conversation of, you know, what does this mean for the trip? Do we need to call it? And luckily, you know, it was sort of superficial frostbite. But we had, you know, that daily reminder every day, the rest of the trip, of when we put our shoes on, it's like another reminder, like, don't mess up. You got your one free, get out of jail free card. So it just sort of, you know, brought the severity of the trip into a clearer picture.
You know, it's such a tough thing to make the right call in those situations. I've not been in anything that, I would say, that far, that deep in the wilderness where it took, you know, more than a day to get out. But I've had a few situations where I had to decide, is it time to try to stop and build a shelter and spend a night that wasn't unplanned for, or to keep moving? And it's such a tough call. And sometimes if you keep moving, you do yourself a lot of harm. And if you stop, you don't know what you're going to get into during the night either. So, man, that would be scary to me. Is that part of the experience there?
Absolutely. And I think for Justin and I, we've hiked a lot of other trails together. A lot of those trails that you mentioned prior, we've done together. And a lot of those trips were a lot of decision-making. So at this point, we know each other really well. We know when to push each other, when to sort of let the other one vent, and when to really probe on the agenda that one person might have, or decision they're leaning towards. Because like you're saying, in those moments, you are having this open conversation, hopefully, of what are our options? What are the consequences? And, you know, what's the best way to move forward? So for me, those moments are really exciting to sort of engage your brain in that way, where you're just doing a lot of fact checking and fact gathering and just trying to make the most informed decision that you can.
Yeah, I can't imagine. You know, I talked to a couple of guys and they decided at the beginning of their journey that if they disagreed on something, rather than arguing about it, they would flip a coin. And it worked for them. But that kind of scares me a little bit. I like consensus a lot. But man, what happens when you lock horns and you just can't agree? Did you guys have a moment like that?
Nothing where we were like butting heads to that extent, but I think we both are in agreement that if we are at that point, we're going to choose the more conservative method. I remember when we were traveling through the High Sierra, once we started getting some more consequential like avalanche terrain, the debate came up of whether we were going to carry one sat phone or two sat phones, meaning if I get buried or you get buried, do we still have a means to call out? And that was probably the most heated debate we had on the whole trip.
You know, I was going to ask about avalanche danger. Maybe we can come back to that in a moment. But how did that end? Two phones or one?
We decided for one. And so, I think we had one phone or a cell phone with a DeLorme and also a sat phone. So in essence, we still had two ways to communicate.
Okay. So you did have a fallback.
Yeah, that was sort of the compromise. You found the middle of the road there.
Sure. Did you guys take a spot tracker or anything like that with you so that you could signal for help?
We just carried a sat phone with us for most of the trip.
Okay.
A satellite phone, sorry.
Yep, I understand. Avalanche danger. We've done a lot of shows on that as well, but it had to be a major concern for this trip. What kind of precautions did you take, and how did you manage to not get buried out there?
Well, that's where I feel like we leaned on Justin as 10 plus years of ski patroller experience under his belt. So he by far is the sort of expert in avalanche terrain. I have some background, but not to the extent of his. And luckily for us, well, lucky I say in some ways, the winter of 2014-15 was just below average. You know, California and the whole Western, or mostly California, had this trip fell within that 5-year drought period. And so that went into our planning process where we knew we wanted to get out of Washington before the snow got too deep. Washington's really steep and the trail sort of blasted into a lot of spots. So that's why we started in the late fall and just wanted to get in as many miles as possible. And then we were trying to time it where we're going to go through the High Sierra, where traditionally there's been a drier January pattern that sets up in the High Sierra. So if we could get to there, that was just going to give us a weather window. But thankfully for most of the trail, there was very few avalanche risks because of the lower than average, snowpack. And that in itself sort of presented a whole series of other challenges. You know, if you're having high avalanche terrain or, conditions, you're going to have to hunker down in your tent and make more informed route choices. But when there's just like sparse snow to travel through, it almost opens up more objective hazards where, you know, things are just barely buried. You know, if there's a down tree or rocks that are just barely covered in snow. So your mode of skiing becomes almost more hazardous in some ways when you're not facing those avalanche concerns.
Yeah, no doubt. So I have to ask, you said that you did several other trips with Justin, but I have found that meeting someone, and I guess someone that you can really rely on, someone that you would invite, it's really tough to find someone that you can really rely on and that you would entertain the idea of going on an epic adventure like this with. So how did you and Justin meet and get to know each other and decide that you guys could rely on each other. I mean, really, you're relying on each other for your lives in this scenario.
Yeah, and I think for us, you know, to take on a trip of this nature, having not had that prior relationship and both having not sort of the extent of experience that we had, you know, I would say first and foremost, this trip would have been a complete failure. But there's sort of a progression in that relationship where, you know, we first met actually on the PCT in 2004. We were both hiking it that summer and sort of just kept in contact. You know, when you're sort of in the migration of finding new trails to do, there's a small network of people to reach out to if you're interested in doing something new or, and we both, sort of heard about this trail that was being developed down in New Zealand, the Te Aroa. After staying in contact for a couple of years, I was heading down there for personal travel and was like, hey, I'm heading down there for this. Do you want to maybe consider doing this trail together? And so that was, you know, a very undefined trail at that point. And there's a lot of route finding and developing our own route. So, you know, not any huge consequence other than getting very lost or misplaced. So, you know, we sort of had that innate progression of sort of smaller consequences, but venturing out and branching out on the skill sets we were developing in tandem with one another.
So it just sounds like it took time together to earn each other's trust and build the skill in that friendship to make something like this possible.
Yeah, it's just, you know, time and miles together. You know, after the Te Aroa trial in New Zealand, we went over to Nepal and heard about this yet another upcoming trail, the Great Himalaya Trail, and that was yet another trail where undefined, high elevation, a lot of unknowns. So we were just sort of upping the ante each time and getting to know each other a little bit more.
So I've got to ask, you know, there are lots of challenges when you take on some venture like this. And I mean, this is a big one. You guys, as far as anybody knows, you guys are the only ones who've ever done this. This is a big one. Why do it? What's the point of coming up with an adventure like this and going for it?
Well, I think for Justin and I, that's really the why is sort of what defines a lot of these trips. And we really have a deep passion for just seeing new terrain, new environments. You know, it's amazing how slowly things unfold when you're walking or at a walking pace. So you really get to immerse yourself in the topography and the environment or culture that you're walking through. And so every turn becomes an unknown and, you know, a surprise or a new challenge. So I think it's sort of the appeal of seeing something new. And I think as of late, it's also the idea of doing something new. So a new mode of travel, trying to branch out from just strictly backpacking or hiking. So ski touring was really a high appeal for us. We both love the PCT and sort of the combination of this question of could it be done and exploring that really narrowed it down to making it a priority, at least a priority to give it a shot.
Well, I think it's an amazing feat that you accomplished, but you know, I have to almost say I'm just as impressed that you've done all this other stuff and that over the years you've consistently gone back and found a way to work such adventures into your life. I think that there are a lot of people that are kind of envious right now because there's so many people that love being out in the woods. They love backpacking. They love through hiking, but finding the time to pull it off, I mean, that's got to be tough for so many people. Any advice for people who are kind of wrestling with that right now?
If you can eliminate as many expenses as possible, it really frees up what you can experience in your life. So if you just look at how many monthly payments you have going to something, whether it's a school loan, a car payment, a phone bill, rent, you know, Netflix, all these monthly expenses, like, do you need that or do you want that? And I think when you like really prioritize what you truly need, I think that's why sort of migrating the ultralight ethos into your daily life just innately opens up more possibilities. You know, if you're just using what you need, it's amazing how far your dollar will stretch.
So would you call yourself a minimalist then?
I've cheap bastard has been maybe.
Oh, that's great. So you guys have a book coming out now about ultralight winter travel. What's the name of this book and how can people find it?
Well, we kept it simple. It's ultralight winter travel. Falcon Guides is going to be putting it out probably this coming fall.
Well, you must have learned a lot about it. And one of the things that I've noted about my winter trips is that everything's heavy. You know, maybe it's because I'm a little bit too chicken to leave some stuff at home in the wintertime. You know, the consequences can be high. But learning how to travel light in the wintertime, I think that's a whole different ballgame. That's not the same thing as a summer trip.
Yeah, and you know, that was our hope with the nature of the book was, you know, Justin's written books about summer ultralight travel. And for both of us, it's just the more we can encourage and create avenues for people to get outside and enjoy the outdoors, you know, I feel like you protect what you know, and what's precious to you is what you know. And if people can experience the outdoors, they're going to innately want to protect those things. So I feel like there's this barrier or mystique around winter travel. It has a lot of worry, and I think for good reason. And our hope with the book is that it provides a simple progression that people can explore and experience and make simple mistakes and sort of learn from them and move forward.
Well, it sounds like a great book, and I'm really interested in skimming through it or reading it in depth, you know, when it does come out, because like I said, that it seems like my winter trips are just far too heavy, which doesn't help when you're on snowshoes or skis. That just makes it all the worse.
Yeah, it's the lighter your pack can be, the more your head can look up and look around.
Yeah, no doubt. So you also have a great website, seanfory.com. That's SHAWNFORRY. And man, you've got information about all these trips so that everyone can go and see and get a lot more information about it. So for instance, I'm hesitating here just looking at it, but beautiful pictures of your trips. What can you tell us about this website? It looks like you put a lot of energy into it.
Yeah, I think the biggest hope I have with, you know, creating some sort of platform or website is to pass along information. So there is like a planning section on a lot of the trails that Justin and I have either helped pioneer or were one of the first to do. There was not a lot of information out when we were planning those trips. So, you know, for us wanting to pay forward to the hiking community of getting the information out there, that way people can get out there and experience these trips themselves. So that's sort of the end goal for me with a website, is just creating a platform or a venue where people can get in touch and discuss and share information.
Right. So I had to note on your website, this is maybe a little off subject, but it's dear to my heart, celiac disease. I have found it to be tough because I'm gluten intolerant. I found it to be tough to manage backpacking food because of that. Can you share more about that?
Yeah, I've had celiacs probably 10 plus years, probably longer. I actually thought I just had Giardia for a decade until I found out I had celiac.
I've been there. Yep.
But yeah, you know, it sort of changes your whole approach to meals. And at first it feels really daunting of like, what am I going to eat? You know, how can I substitute all these things? And over time you sort of figure out different menus or different meals. And I think even now in the outdoor food scene, there's more gluten-free options and it just gets better and better. I mean, you can get gluten-free Big Bars now or gluten-free pizza in town. So it feels like it's getting easier and easier to sort of get back on the end of the spectrum of things you used to eat. There's some sort of substitute now.
Right. Well, let's just briefly talk about food. Did you guys use just dehydrated food on this trip, or do you have another strategy for how to eat?
I feel like we use just normal. Well, we generally use just normal backpacking food. Honestly, whatever tastes good, I think, is the more important thing at the time. But for the winter trip in particular, the one tweak that we did make to our food scene was any food we were going to eat during the day, so on the go, had to be zero prep. So it was a lot of like energy bars and string cheese and meat sticks and anything you could just open and put in your mouth was going to be the most efficient way to sort of get the calories in without getting too cold.
Right. So you can eat while you move and stay warm.
Yeah. And then, you know, the winter opens up other possibilities of just carrying butter or anything from the freezer aisle. A hot meal at the end of the day was a huge morale boost for us. And, even hot drinks. Usually I don't carry any sort of like tea or, hot cocoa or whatever during the summer, but in the winter time, it's such a nice way to sort of rehydrate at the end of the day and, get some more calories in.
Yeah. You know, I think that I've been struggling with backpacking food for probably 20 years, and I keep refining it and learning more and more. I'll bet you are an expert just because you've spent so much time doing it. But I think the more of it that you do, the more you learn, and the more sorts of little tricks you find that really work for you. So I guess it has a lot to do with individual taste, doesn't it?
Yeah, and at some point, I hear you. You just get burned out with traditional food, and sometimes you just got to carry the glass jar of maple syrup. It's okay.
Yeah,
just do it. You'll appreciate it.
Well, I think that's kind of where I landed. Was I'm just going to carry a little bit more weight so that I can have the foods that I love while I'm out there. Well, that's awesome.
Exactly.
Well, what kind of a ending story do you have? Is something to make us laugh or inspire us? There have to be some amazing stories from this trip.
Let's see here. I think the big motivator for us, during the trip was, like we mentioned earlier, that, you know, almost the entirety of the trip, we didn't see anyone else out there. And I think what showcases sort of how tight knit, the hiking community is as we got further and further south, there sort of became this momentum building in the outdoor community. And, you know, we were getting a lot of supportive emails or just Facebook messages, just people encouraging us. And that just meant a lot when we got into a town and sort of regrouped. Just, you know, if you had a really tough experience or previous miles, just to get in and have that sort of psychological boost, was really, really key. And I think even more so along the PCT, there's this network of trail angels, or these people that will, out of the kindness of their heart, take you in or provide a meal or transport you to a trailhead. And during the summertime, they're so overrun with so many other hikers, and it sort of just becomes a business to some degree. Where in the winter, you know, we're the only people there, so you got to have these more intimate conversations and get to know these people more on a one-on-one level. And I think that meant a lot to both of us, that it just felt really special that we got to have that one-on-one time with just these incredible network of people along the trail that are out of the kindness of the heart will take you in. I mean, there's these trail angels called the Softleys down in Southern California, and they probably take in, you know, 2,000 hikers every year, 2,000 or 3,000 hikers. So they all come through and use their toilet. so that's the level of like gratitude and appreciation that we have for those people. And they meant a lot for us along the way, and just provide an unmeasurable amount of mental support.
Isn't it wonderful when you get out and you meet people and you find out how wonderful people can be? It just kind of redeems your whole opinion of the human race, you know?
Yeah. And I would say your typical long distance hiker looks very close to a homeless person. So, you know, there's a lot of bias and judgment and preconceived notions of what this person is that's trying to hitch a ride somewhere or trying to shop through the grocery store. And I think people can see through that and see the greater thing that's happening.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's great. Well, Sean, thank you so much for your time today, man. It was a real pleasure to make your acquaintance, and I hope that we can have you on the show again and we can talk about some of these other big adventures. So just before we go, I have to know, what are you planning for next?
That's the million-dollar question, right?
Yep.
There's always something on the tick list, and I think as of now, just a short trip probably for this winter. Justin and I are planning on just doing a quick lap, ski tour lap around the Tahoe Rim Trail this winter. So about 250-mile ski tour around the Lake Tahoe.
Oh, just a little stroll in the park for you then.
Just quick jaunt, stretch the leg.
That's awesome. Well, congratulations to you and to Justin. You know, it's an amazing feat what you did, but I think that what's wonderful about it is that you are bringing back the memories and sharing the stories and the know-how and kind of forging new ground for others who are going to look to this for years to come. So thanks a lot, man.
Yeah, my pleasure, Kurt. Appreciate it.
You bet. And for all the listeners out there, wow, amazing, huh? Don't forget, it doesn't matter what the season is. It doesn't matter how hard it might be. There's always a way to get out there and have some fun.
First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to grow in the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
Studies show that 100% of everybody in the world wants to curl up indoors and do nothing because it's so darn cold out there. That's why many people are turning to Bombas, whose pillowy plush slippers and warm merino wool socks have been said to be the most comfortable in the history of feet. Bombas products have been found to boost coziness by up to 1 million percent. Okay, enough fake statistics, but could Bombas socks and slippers really be the cure? Go to bombas.com/audio and use code AUDIO for 20% off your first purchase. That's BOMBAS.com and use code AUDIO.